Tom John awoke, shivering. The room was dark. Outside, a few stars pierced the mist of the city, and there was the occasional whistle of burglars and footpads as they went about their strictly lawful occasions. There was silence from the next room, but he could see the light of a candle under the door. He went back to bed. Across the turgid river, the Fool had also awakened. He was staying at the Fool's Guild, not out of choice, but because the Duke hadn't given him any money for anything else, and getting to sleep had been difficult in any case. The chilly walls had brought back too many memories. Besides, if he listened hard, he could hear the muted sobs and occasional whimpers from the students' dormitories as they contemplated with horror the life that lay ahead of them. Punched the rock-hard pillow and sank into a fitful sleep. A chance to dream.
Slab and Grew, yes. But it doesn't say how Slab and Grew.
Goody Wimper recommended testing a bit in a cup of cold water like toffee.
How inconvenient that we didn't think to bring one, McGrath.
I think we should be getting on, Esme. The night's nearly gone.
Just don't blame me if it doesn't work properly, that's all. Let's see. Baboon hair and... Who's got the baboon hair? Oh, thank you, Gaither. That looks more like cat hair to me, but never mind. Baboon hair and mandrake root. And if that's real mandrake, I'm very surprised. Carrot juice and tongue of boot. I see. Little humour, I suppose.
Please hurry.
All right, all right. Owl hoot and glowworm glimmer. Boil and then allow to simmer.
You know, Esme, this doesn't taste half bad.
You're not supposed to drink it, you daft Oyen.
Tom John sat bolt upright in bed. That was them again. The same faces, the bickering voices, distorted by time and space. Even after he looked out of the window, where fresh daylight was streaming through the city, he could still hear the voices grumbling into the distance, like old thunder fading away.
I, for one, didn't believe it about the tongue of boot.
It's still very runny. Do you think we should put some corn flour in it?
It won't matter. Either he's on his way or he isn't.
He got up and doused his face in the washbasin. Silence rolled in swathes from Howell's room. Tom John slipped on his clothes and pushed open the door. It looked as though it had snowed indoors, great heavy flakes that had drifted into odd corners of the room. Howell sat at his low table in the middle of the floor, his head pillowed on a pile of paper, snoring. Tom John tiptoed across the room and piled up a discarded ball of paper at random. He smoothed it out and read, King, now I am just going to put the crown on this bush here, and you will tell me if anyone tries to take it, won't you?
Groundlings, yes.
King, now, if I could just find my horsey. First assassin pops up behind rock. Audience.
Behind you!
First assassin disappears. King.
You're trying to play tricks on old Kingy, you naughty.
There was a lot of crossing out and a large blot. Tom John threw it aside and selected another ball at random. King. Is this a... duck, knife,
dagger? I see...
behind... beside, in front of...
before me? It's...
beak.
Handle? Pointing at me... my hand?
First murderer. Oh, no, it isn't.
If faith, it is not so.
Second murderer.
Oh, yes, it is.
Thou speakest true, sir.
Judging by the creases in the paper, this one had been thrown at the wall particularly hard. Howell had once explained to Tom John his theory about inspirations, and by the look of it, a whole shower had fallen last night. Fascinated by this insight into the creative processes, however, Tom John tried a third discarded attempt. Queen. Faith, there is a sound without. Mayhap it is my husband returning. Quick, into the gaudy robe, and wait not upon the order of your going. Murderer, marry, but your maid still has my pantoufle. Maid, opening door. The Archbishop, your Majesty. Priest, under bed. Bless my soul. Divers alarums. Tom John wondered vaguely what divers alarums, which Howell always included somewhere in the stage directions, actually were. Howell always refused to say. Perhaps they referred to dangerous depths, or lack of air pressure. He sidled towards the table, and with great care pulled the sheaf of paper from under the sleeping dwarf's head, lowering it gently onto a cushion. The top sheet read, Verence, Felmet, Small Gods, Eve,
a knight of
Knives, Daggers,
Kings by Howell of Vitala's Men, a
comedy,
tragedy in
8, 5, 6, 3,
9 acts. Characters, Felmet, a good king, Verence, a bad king,
Worthy Wax, an evil witch,
Hog, and likewise evil witch,
Margaret,
and Siren.
Tom flicked over the page.
Scene, a
drawing room, ship at sea, street in Pseudopolis.
Blasted Moor. Enter, three witches.
The boy read for a while, and then turned to the last page. Gentles, leave us, dance and sing, and wish good health unto the king. Exeunt all, singing fa-la-la, etc. Shower of rose petals, ringing of bells, gods descend from heaven, demons rise from hell, much ado with the turntable, etc. The end. Howell snored. In his dreams, gods rose and fell. Ships moved with cunning and art across canvas oceans. Pictures jumped and ran together and became flickering images. Men flew on wires, flew without wires. Great ships of illusion fought against one another in imaginary skies. Seas opened. Ladies were sawn in half. 1,000 special effects men giggled and gibbered. Through it all he ran with his arms open in desperation, knowing that none of this really existed, or ever would exist, and all he really had was a few square yards of planking, some canvas and some paint, on which to trap the beckoning images that invaded his head. Only in our dreams are we free. The rest of the time we need wages.
"It's a good play," said Vitola. "Apart from the ghost."
"The ghost stays,"
said Howell sullenly.
"But people always jeer and throw things. Anyway, you know how hard it is to get all the chalk dust out of the clothes."
"The ghost stays. It's a dramatic necessity."
"You said it was a dramatic necessity in the last play."
"Well, it was."
"And in Please Yourself, and in A Wizard of Ankh, and all the rest of them."
"I like ghosts."
They stood to one side and watched the dwarf artificers assembling the wave machine. It consisted of 6 long spindles, covered in complex canvas spirals, painted in shades of blue and green and white, and stretching the complete width of the stage. An arrangement of cogs and endless belts led to a treadmill in the wings. When the spirals were all turning at once, people with weak stomachs had to look away.
"Sea battles," breathed Howell. "Shipwrecks, tritons, pirates."
"Squeaky bearings, laddie,"
groaned Vitola, shifting his weight on his stick.
"Maintenance expenses over time."
"It does look extremely intricate,"
Howell admitted.
"Who designed it?"
"A daft old chap in the street of cunning artificers,"
said Vitola.
Leonard of Quirm. He's a painter, really. He just does this sort of thing for a hobby. I happened to hear that he's been working on this for months. I just snapped it up quick when he couldn't get it to fly.
They watched the mock waves turn.
You're bent on going, said Vitola at last.
Yes, Tom John's still a bit wild. He needs an older head around the place.
I'll miss you, laddie. I don't mind telling you. You've been like a son to me. How old are you exactly? I never did know.
102.
Vitola nodded gloomily. He was 60, and his arthritis was playing him up.
You've been like a father to me, then, he said.
It evens out in the end, said Howell, diffidently. Half the height, twice the age. You could say that, on the overall average, we live about the same length of time as humans.
The playmaster sighed.
Well, I don't know what I will do without you and Tom John around, and that's a fact.
It's only for the summer, and a lot of the lads are staying. In fact, it's mainly the apprentices that are going, and you said yourself it'd be good experience.
Vitola looked wretched, and in the chilly air of the half-finished theatre, a good deal smaller than usual, like a balloon 2 weeks after the party. He prodded some wood shavings distractedly with his stick.
We grow old, Master Howell. At least,
he corrected himself,
I grow old, and you grow older. We have heard the gongs at midnight.
Aye, you don't want him to go, do you?
I was all for it at first, you know. Then I thought, there's destiny afoot. Just when things are going well, there's always bloody destiny. I mean, that's where he came from, somewhere up in the mountains. Now fate is calling him back. I shan't see him again.
Sorry for the summer.
Vitola held up a hand.
Don't interrupt. I'd got the right dramatic flow there.
Sorry.
Flick, flick, went the stick on the wood shavings, knocking them into the air.
I mean, you know he's not my flesh and blood.
He's your son, though, said Howell. This hereditary business isn't all it's cracked up to be.
It's fine of you to say that.
I mean it. Look at me. I wasn't supposed to be writing plays. Dwarfs aren't even supposed to be able to read. I shouldn't worry too much about destiny if I was you. I was destined to be a miner. Destiny gets it wrong half the time.
But you said he looks like the fool person. I can't see it myself, mark you.
The light's got to be right.
Could be some destiny at work there.
Howell shrugged. Destiny was funny stuff, he knew. You couldn't trust it. Often you couldn't even see it. Just when you knew you had it cornered, it turned out to be something else. Coincidence, maybe, or providence. You barred the door against it, and it was standing behind you. Then just when you thought you had it nailed down, it walked away with a hammer. He used destiny a lot. As a tool for his plays, it was even better than a ghost. There was nothing like a bit of destiny to get the old plot rolling, but it was a mistake to think you could spot the shape of it, and as for thinking it could be controlled. Granny Weatherwax squinted irritably into Nanny Ogg's crystal ball. It wasn't a particularly good one, being a greenish glass fishing float brought back from Fawn's seaside parts by one of her sons. It distorted everything, including, she suspected, the truth.
"He's definitely on his way," she said at last. "In a cart."
"A furry white charger would have been favourite," said Nanny Ogg. "You know, caparisoned and that."
"Has he got a magic sword?" said McGrath, craning to see. Granny Weatherwax sat back.
"You're a disgrace, the pair of you," she said. "I don't know. Magic chargers, fiery swords, ogling away like a couple of milkmaids."
"A magic sword is important," said said McGrath. You've got to have one. We could make him one, she added wistfully, out of thunderbolt iron. I've got a spell for that. You take some thunderbolt iron, she said uncertainly, and then you make a sword out of it.
I can't be having with that old stuff, said Granny. You can wait days for the damn things to hit, and then they nearly take your arm off.
And a strawberry birthmark, said Nanny Ogg, ignoring the interruption. The other two looked at her expectantly.
A strawberry birthmark, she repeated. It's one of those things you've got to have if you're a prince coming to claim your kingdom. That's so everyone will know. Of course, I don't know how they know it's strawberry.
Can't abide strawberries,
said Granny vaguely, quizzing the crystal again. In its cracked green depths, smelling of bygone lobsters, a minute Tom John kissed his parents, shook hands or hugged the rest of the company, and climbed aboard the leading Lattie. It must have worked, she told herself, else he wouldn't be coming here, would he? All those others must be his trusty band of good companions. After all, common sense. He's got to come 500 miles across difficult country. Anything could happen. I dare say the armour and swords is in the cart. She detected a twinge of doubt and set out to quell it instantly. There isn't any other reason for him to come. Stands to reason. We got the spell exactly right, except for the ingredients and most of the poetry, and it probably wasn't the right time. And Gaither took most of it home for the cat, which couldn't have been proper. But he's on his way. What can't speak can't lie.
Best put the cloth over it when you've done, Esme, said Nanny. I always get worried someone will peer in at me when I'm having my bath.
He's on his way,
said Granny, the satisfaction in her voice so strong you could have ground corn with it. She dropped the black velvet bag over the bore.
It's a long road, said Nanny. There's many a slip twixt dress and drawers. There could be bandits.
We shall watch over him, said Granny.
That's not right. If he's going to be king, he ought to be able to fight his own battles, said McGrath.
We don't want him to go wasting his strength, said Nanny primly. We want him good and fresh for when he gets here.
And then I hope we shall leave him to fight his battles in his own way, said McGrath. Granny clapped her hands together in a businesslike fashion.
Quite right, she said, provided he looks like winning.
They had been meeting at Nanny Ogg's cottage. McGrath made an excuse to tarry after Granny left, around dawn, allegedly to help Nanny with tidying up.
"Whatever happened to not meddling?" she said. "What do you mean?" "You know, Nanny."
"It's not proper meddling," said Nanny awkwardly. "Just helping matters along."
"Surely you can't really think that." Nanny sat down and fidgeted with a cushion.
"Well, see, all this non-meddling business is fine in the normal course of things," she said. "Not meddling is easy when you don't have to. And then I've got the family to think about. Oh, Jason's been in a couple of fights because of what people have been saying. Oh, Sean was thrown out of the army. The way I see it, when we get the new king in, he should owe us a few favours. It's only fair."
"But only last week you were saying—" McGrath stopped, shocked at this display of pragmatism.
"A week's a long time in magic," said Nanny. 15 years for one thing. Anyway, Esme is determined, and I'm in no mood to stop her."
"So what you're saying," said McGrath icily, "is that this not meddling thing is like taking a vow not to swim. You'll absolutely never break it, unless, of course, you happen to find yourself in the water.
Better than drowning, said Nanny.
She reached up to the mantelpiece and took down a clay pipe that was like a small tar pit. She lit it with a spill from the remains of the fire, while Grebo watched her carefully from his cushion. McGrath idly lifted the hood from the ball and glared at it. I think, she said, that I will never really understand about witchcraft. Just when I think I've got a grip on it, changes.
We're all just people.
Nanny blew a cloud of blue smoke at the chimney.
Everyone's just people.
Can I borrow the crystal? Said McGrath suddenly.
Feel free, said Nanny.
She grinned at McGrath's back.
Had a row with your young man, she said.
I really don't know what you're talking about.
Haven't seen him around for weeks.
Oh, the Duke sent him to... McGrath stopped and went on. Sent him away for something or other. Not that it bothers me at all, either way.
So I see. Take the ball by all means.
McGrath was glad to get back home. No one was about on the moors at night anyway, but over the last couple of months, things had definitely been getting worse. On top of the general suspicion of witches, it was dawning on the few people in Loughborough who had any dealings with the outside world that, A, either more things had been happening than they had heard about before, or, B, time was out of joint. It wasn't easy to prove. Because of the way time was recorded among the various states, kingdoms, and cities. After all, when over an area of 100 square miles the same year is variously the year of the small bat, the anticipated monkey, the hunting cloud, fat cows, 3 bright stallions, and at least 9 numbers recording the time since the calendar of the theocracy of Muntab counts down, not up. No one knows why, but it might not be a good idea to hang around to find out. Assorted kings, prophets, and strange events were either crowned, born, or happened, and each year has a different number of months. And some of them don't have weeks. And one of them refuses to accept the day as a measure of time. The only thing it is possible to be sure of is that good sex doesn't last long enough. Except for the Zamingo tribe of the Great Neff, of course. But the few traders who came along the mountain tracks after the winter seemed to be rather older than they should have been. Unexplained happenings are always more or less expected in the Ramtops because of the high magical potential, but several years disappearing overnight was a bit of a first. She locked the door, fastened the shutters, and carefully laid the green glass globe on the kitchen table. She concentrated. The fool dozed under the tarpaulins of a river barge, heading up the Ankh at a steady 2 miles an hour. It wasn't an exciting method of transport, but it got you there eventually. He looked safe enough, but he was tossing and turning in his sleep. McGrath wondered what it was like spending your whole life doing something you didn't want to. Like being dead, she considered. Only worse, the reason being you were alive to suffer it. She considered the fool to be weak, badly led, and sorely in need of some backbone, and she was longing for him to get back, so she could look forward to never seeing him again. It was a long, hot summer. They didn't rush things. There was a lot of country between Ankh Morpork and the Ramtops. It was, Howell had to admit, fun. It wasn't a word dwarfs were generally at home with. Please yourself went over well. It always did. The apprentices excelled themselves. They forgot lines and played jokes. In Stolat, the whole third act of Gretelina and Melaeus was performed against the backdrop for the second act of the Mage Wars. No one seemed to notice that the greatest love scene in history was played on a set depicting a tidal wave sweeping across a continent. That was possibly because Tom John was playing Gretelina. The effect was so disconcertingly riveting that Howell made him swap roles for the next house, if you could apply the term to a barn hired for the day, and the effect still had more rivets than a suit of plate armour, including the helmet. And even though Gretelina in this case was now young Wimslow, who was a bit simple, intended to stutter, and whose spots might eventually clear up. The following day, in some nameless village in the middle of an endless sea of cabbages, he let Tom John play Old Miskin in Please Yourself, a role that Vitola had always excelled in. You couldn't let anyone play it who was under the age of 40, not unless you wanted an old Miskin with a cushion up his jerkin and grease paint wrinkles. Howell didn't consider himself old. His father had still been digging 3 tons of ore a day at the age of 200. Now, he felt old. He watched Tom John hobble off the stage, and for a fleeting instant knew what it was to be a fat old man, pickled in wine, fighting old wars that no one cared about anymore, hanging grimly onto the precipice of late middle age for fear of dropping off into antiquity, but only with one hand, because with the other he was raising 2 fingers at death. Of course he'd known that when he wrote the part, but he hadn't known it. The same magic didn't seem to infuse the new play. They tried it a few times just to see how it went. The audience watched attentively and went home. They didn't even bother to throw anything. It wasn't that they thought it was bad. They didn't think it was anything. But all the right ingredients were there, weren't they? Tradition was full of people giving evil rulers a well-justified seeing-to. Witches were always a draw. The apparition of death was particularly good, and some lovely lines. Mix them all together, and they seemed to cancel out, become a mere humdrum way of filling the stage for a couple of hours. Late at night, when the cast was asleep, Howell would sit up in one of the carts and feverishly rewrite. He rearranged scenes, cut lines, added lines, introduced a clown, included another fight, and tuned up the special effects. Didn't seem to have any effect. The play was like some marvellous, intricate painting, a feast of impressions close to, a mere blur from a distance. When the inspirations were sleeting fast, he even tried changing the style. In the morning, the early risers grew accustomed to finding discarded experiments decorating the grass around the carts, like extremely literate mushrooms. Tom John kept one of the strangest. First witch, he's late. Pause. Second witch, he said he would come. Pause. Third witch, he said he would come, but he hasn't. This is my last newt. I saved it for him, and he hasn't come. Pause. I think, said Tom John later, you ought to slow down a bit. You've done what was ordered. No one said it had to sparkle.
It could, you know, if I could just get it right.
You're absolutely sure about the ghost, are you? Said Tom John. The way he threw the line away made it clear he wasn't.
There's nothing wrong with the ghost, snapped Howell. The scene with the ghost is the best I've done.
I was just wondering if this is the right play for it, that's all.
The ghost stays. Now let's get on, boy.